Who is the prayer opener?
Yeah, our chairwoman isn't here.
We have a chairwoman?
Our chairwoman is off on the retreat.
Oh. We've got to agonize in prayer.
I'll pray.
There we go. Oh, there we go. Excellent.
Lord God, I just thank you that we could all meet here this morning, and I thank you for bringing Dr. Dolphin here to share with us, God. And I pray that you would just open our hearts to your word, Lord, that we could receive the things that you need to teach us through it this morning, God. And I just pray that you'd be with us in our time here and bless this house and all these wonderful people here with me. In Jesus' name.
Amen. All those who managed to survive the avalanche and come back here are required to do makeup exam, and they should bring a note from Mother excusing them from class today.
We'll tell them that.
I think that would be, wouldn't that be about right? And then they'll have to sign off. Carrie will have to sign them off.
Okay.
It would be just a natural.
Okay.
Nothing out of the ordinary. The book of Ecclesiastes is a book about all the things in life that don't work. All of the things that you can try and do which will end up emptiness with emptiness and vanity. And Solomon was the richest man in the ancient world and the wisest man in the ancient world. Lived about 3,000 years ago. And he went on a elaborate research project to find what brought meaning to life, whether it was to be found in pleasure, or the pursuit of knowledge, or wisdom, or science. He studied everything and came to the conclusion that life is meaningless whenever you leave God out of what you're doing, which is the most important insight in the whole book. And that the moment you allow Jesus to have a place in the activities of your life, then everything is meaningful. So that's the exact reverse of this. So this is not a book about life being meaningless. It's a book about life doesn't work when you exclude God from what you're up to. And this man knows more about that than any of us have ever had time or money or to research as thoroughly as he did. So this is the report from the investigative reporter, the Kohelet, the searcher. We looked at the pursuit of wealth, and the comparison of wealth and poverty. We looked at the fact that life throws curveballs at us, that there sometimes is injustice in the courts and injustice in government, and people suffer wrongs that are not corrected. And those things are all in life. And at the close of chapter 5, verse 18, the conclusion of chapter 5 is kind of a summary of some of these things in this previous section. Here is what I have seen. Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for me to eat and drink and to enjoy the good, for one, to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun, all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. For every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. God will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. The conclusion, in a way, here is that that God intends that everyone should work and eat and enjoy the fruits of his labors and live a good life, regardless of some of the circumstances. The gift of God is a good life. And God is able to give you joy and happiness and contentment in everything you do. So that life is not meaningless by nature. It was created to be meaningful, and God would like it to be that for us and for all men. He'd like that for all men. And to some extent, he gives that to all men, whether even to people when they don't pay too much attention to it. So right away you can see here that living in the world requires that we work, that we labor, that we pay our own way, that we have times for relaxation, that we have friends, that we ought to be able to take pleasure in life. So that's all part of God's intention in creating us. We're not supposed to live boring lives. Our lives do have meaning and purpose. And God would prefer that we all have the joy day by day of the life the way He intended it. So that sort of summarizes the previous chapters. Now in chapter 6, there's this next section is on the futility of riches, which he's already touched upon. The great danger to the wealthy is that status never is an end in itself. It never leads you anywhere. Your social standing is not the end. In and of itself, that isn't going to make your life happy. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is common among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that he lacks nothing for himself of all he desires, yet God does not give him power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity, and it is an evil affliction. If a man begets 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness, or indeed he has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For that child comes in vanity and departs in darkness, and its name is covered with darkness. Though it has not seen the sun or known anything, this stillborn baby has more rest than that man, even if he lives 1,000 years twice over, but has not seen goodness. Do not all go to one place. All right, now then, we consider the case of a man who, either through his inheritance or his hard work, has become very wealthy and lacks nothing. He lacks nothing material, so he can write a check for anything he would like to do. Take a vacation in the Bahamas, he can buy himself a nice new jet airplane and have Dr. Anderson fly him around the world, or he can get a yacht, or he can throw a party. But what's lacking in his life? God has not given this man the power to enjoy his wealth. That's the fundamental theme. If God doesn't give you joy, you won't get it any other way. It's not to be found anyplace else. And God gives joy and contentment to those people that please Him only. Remember that? So what a sad state this is, to be in the position to buy anything, be in the position financially to enjoy life up to the hill, and then have it elude you. As a matter of fact, what can happen in this man's life is what? A foreigner consumes it. Man doesn't have his eyes on God. He's not paying any attention to God. He can get cheated out of his money. He can go bankrupt. He can get ripped off in a bad business deal. Any number of things can happen. And then what? Then what? What is it? What a loss. What a sad loss. He has neither happiness, and now he's lost all his wealth. That's terrible. Now, this guy has 100 children. And you'd think, wow, 100 wonderful kids to talk to enjoy, to have over, to go places with, to get to know. But his soul is not satisfied with goodness. In other words, God has heaped on him the blessing of 100 wonderful kids, but he doesn't have the power to enjoy them. He's bitter and cynical and disinterested and can't enjoy his own kids. And Solomon says of that man, he's worse off than an abortion, than a stillborn child. It's another way of saying it'd be better for him never to be born than to live that much misery. Not only in this life, but in the next life. To totally miss the meaning of life and to have no capacity to enjoy it and enjoy all the good things that God gave him. And so this little picture here of the stillborn child, totally innocent, came out of his mother's womb in darkness and dies right away and vanishes into darkness and never sees the light of day and goes right back to God. That stillborn child was a great tragedy. But that little stillborn child is better off than this rich, wealthy, bitter, cynical old man who had all this wealth and all this opportunity and blew it. There's the strong contrast that Solomon makes for us. All go to the same place. In the Jewish concept, death is always called Sheol. It's just the grave. It doesn't mean necessarily heaven or hell, anything. It just means the end of life, Sheol, the grave, the underworld. So the stillborn child goes to the grave. The rich man goes to the grave. They both end up in the same place. That's the whole idea. And that's kind of sad when you think of the Silicon Valley, which has very many very wealthy people in it, with their cars and their houses and their lifestyles, and all their luxuries, and without God, they're not going to have the capacity to enjoy any of it. That's really very sad, then. That's why he says this is, and when the term under the sun in Ecclesiastes, under the sun always means we're looking at the world from the natural standpoint, where God's not involved. We're looking at the world as it is when you don't bring God into consideration. Now, the next little section is that work is designed to meet our needs, that God intends that we should work. Adam had to till the garden in Eden before the fall. God planted a beautiful garden in Eden and filled it with all sorts of fruits and trees, and it was a garden planted by God. And God said to Adam, okay, I want you to manage the garden, which is work. I want you to take care of the animals, which is work. And later on, I want you to explore outside the garden. I'm putting you in charge of the garden as the head gardener, and I'm putting you as the steward over the universe. So that's a life of work. So work is legitimate. All the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet his soul is not satisfied. What more has the wise man than the fool? What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wondering of desire. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Anybody want to explain that? You work hard in order to have enough to eat and have comforts. But there's a danger in it. Well, if you've left God out, you're not going to be satisfied, even with something legitimate like work and the reward that work is. What more has the wise man than the fool? What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? Well, in the end, if neither are happy, it doesn't matter very much. But we've already seen in this that it's better to be a wise person, just because you're likely to not be quite so, make so many stupid mistakes. But in the end, it all levels out if you're unhappy and you're miserable and God hasn't had anything to do with your life. Better is the sight of your eyes. That would be better is the enjoyment of the things God has given you right now than the wondering of desire. The wondering of desire would be covetousness or lust. Better is that you enjoy the situation you're in right now. Enjoy your friends. Enjoy the beautiful day. Enjoy the beautiful weather. Enjoy the music at the concert. God intends you to do that. But how often is the wondering of desire? How often is something, this craving for more, this wanting something you don't really need, which is covetousness, wanting more than you have. The lust that is insatiable, that burns inside, that just demands sex, money, power for its own self, and is burning empty desire. If you're all full of lust and selfish desire, then you can't enjoy the moment. Then you're not free to take enjoyment of the good things that God would like you to enjoy today. That all sort of makes sense? Whatever, verse 10, whatever one is, he has been named already. For it is known that he is a man, and that he cannot contend with God, who is mightier than he. Since there are many things that increase vanity, how is man the better? Now that's a little bit difficult to unravel. This is not about fatalism, but it says, whatever you are right now as a human being, as a man or a woman, has been determined by God, right? Who you are as a person, your personality, your strengths, your weaknesses, your gifts, what you look like, everything about you has God decided that. You didn't. You didn't get to choose your genes and chromosomes or your parents, your status in life. You didn't choose any of this. God gave that to you as a gift. What if you don't like who you are? Well, this is the old argument of the pot and the potter. Should the pot say to the potter, I don't like the kind of pot you're making me into, or I want to be a pot that has handles, I want to be a little teapot, or I'd like to have a porcelain glaze. What good would it do for the piece of clay on the potter's wheel to complain to the potter? Well, the potter is going to do whatever he pleases. In fact, that runs through the whole Bible. And if the pot should be really ruined, the potter just throws it out in the scrap pile. And who could complain? That's the idea. So God made you who you are. And what can you do about it? Do you want to go argue with God? Do you want to go wrestle with God? Would you like to go complain to God? It won't do you any good. and he says there's a lot of things in life that make you vain, and how are you the better off because of that? In other words, there's a certain contentment in your limitations and your circumstances. There's a certain, you're not God, you're created for God's own good pleasure. He put you here, he likes you, he likes who you are, he made you special and unique. Don't go trying to be something that you're not, because it's empty. What's it going to get you? Hero worship of some kind. And there's our whole culture is full of that, of wanting to be the great football star or the great actress or the great rock singer or the great somebody or other. And God didn't make you that. So if he made you an ordinary person, well, then he's able to fulfill you as an ordinary person. So this is a little thing about the limitation.
But I like that, because that's really refreshing to know that it's not, like, I don't have to do these things, all these things to find enjoyment or contentment.
That's exactly right. The enjoyment is a gift of God, and it has nothing to do with your striving, or it has nothing to do with your efforts. And what about all the advertising on television? What does all the ads on television tell you?
You need more.
How about a better toothpaste? How about a better aftershave lotion? What if you buy somebody's t-shirt from somebody or other? What if you use Listerine? What's the implied in all advertising? Make you a better person. You're going to get the lover of your choice. The person that you can't get close to is going to come running up to you and give you a big hug if you'll just switch over to this new product. Isn't that the whole idea? You haven't got what it takes right now, but if you'll buy our product, you'll get it.
I knew I should have got this.
So that's the big lie that we're barraged with all day long, is you haven't got what it takes right now, but we can help you.
it's interesting because, like, I think so many times we think the things that are going to bring us contentment and are like these other things, like, you know, we're just talking about like a big family or a long life or you know, but like a job or status or something like that. And yet those are the things that really we don't have much control over. And so it's sad. If those were the things that brought contentment, like, we'd be pretty hopeless.
Yeah.
But, you know, here, you know, the things that really are going to bring us contentment, like that favor from God, are the things that, like, is just a gift from God.
And He'd like it to be day by day.
Yeah.
He would like you to be able to be, at the end of the day, to be happy about today. Even if today had some bad spots in it, He'd like you to go sleep at night with a sense of peace, and today was a good day, and we'll take tomorrow.
Yeah.
The last verse in this chapter is very good. For who knows what is good for man in life all the days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? Brevity of life there. Who can tell you what is best for your life? Who can tell you what the future holds? Who's in charge of history? Who is it that knows what's really best for you? Who knows what's the best choice for you? Well, God knows those things. God knows the future. He knows that what's going to happen tomorrow, a big earthquake, an avalanche in the Sierras, a plane crashing into the third story because Anderson was drunk when he was flying. He wasn't watching where he was landing the helicopter. And
happened to drift over into the neighbor's house.
He drifted over into the neighbor's house and landed in the girl's dorm. Started evangelizing over there. Well, see here, though, how little control we have over circumstances in our lives. A good God wants to make your life rich and full, but this would presuppose that you're going to allow God freedom in your life to move you and change your directions and bless you. And the future is uncertain for every single one of us in this room. We don't know about tomorrow. And it's not predictable. And then now, here's where all of the economic forecasts are iffy. This is where all the Bible prophecies are uncertain. This is where all the soothsayers would like to give you a plan or give you good advice on what to do. And it's all fake. Because only God knows. Well, in other words, if you just forget about God, then pretty well everything is meaningless around you. But of course, the whole point of all this is the moment you've brought God into your plans, it's all full of meaning. Because God will see to it that your life is meaning. It's His desire to give meaning and blessing. Chapter 7, we live in an evil world, and Solomon doesn't deny that. He says a good name is better than precious ointment. And the day of death is better than the day of one's birth. There's a little play of words in verse 1. A good name, the Hebrew for name is Shem, Shem, S-H-E-M. The word for ointment is Shemen. A good name, a good Shem is better than precious Shemen. So that's the play on words there. Good name. What does it mean to have a good name? Why would that be better than precious ointment? Character? Reputation? Yeah. No? You're trustworthy? If people speak well of you? That's a pretty neat thing to have. Instead of it being a sleazy, disreputable, untrustworthy, no good bum. Why is the day of your death better than the day of your birth? Well, all the suffering and hardships all over with. God's going to take away all of your anxieties and reward you with eternal life. And all the worries and fears are all going to vanish away. And you're going to be with all the people that you love and care about. And when you're born into the world, it's put all sorts of uncertainties. You could get sick. You could have abusive parents. You could be born in the middle of a war, or you could have to go through who knows what kind of tragedies. So that's kind of the scary thing about when children come into the world. I know parents today worry a lot about the world their kids are going to grow up in and do their very best to help their kids cope with things that are really bad, getting worse. So when you finish the end of your life, you can sort of breathe a sigh of relief and say, I made it, that's over. And obviously there's a connection here between the good name is better than precious ointment, because the person who has a good name doesn't have anything to be afraid of before God. God's going to reward and bless that person. It is better to go to the house of mourning than the house of feasting. For that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. Now there's a contrast here between... You could misunderstand this. You could misread this to think that Solomon is saying it's better that you run around as an ultra-conservative, cautious, reluctant, hesitant, over-serious person who never has any fun at all. You could read it that way. That's not what it means. What does it mean? Two kinds of people in life. The house of mourning, the house of feasting. Well, feasting would be our word partying, which is escapism. How many people do you know who can't wait for the weekend so they can go out and get drunk?
Well, I know about 60 guys.
This dirty house. You can't wait for the ski trip to the Sierras so you can throw away all caution. Not our group. None of our skiers, but we've heard of others. So the house of mirth here would be the person who's happy-go-lucky, couldn't care less, lives the good life, goes to Las Vegas. How about people in Las Vegas? You ever see people in the casinos? All glazy eyes, pulling the one-arm bandit, putting in their quarters, and they're having the wonderful time of their lives. Absolutely wonderful time, hour after hour after hour, watching the wheels spin.
But that's what brings pleasure.
And it brings pleasure, and for sure they're going to hit the jackpot. And it's dark and smoky in there. And then they get free cocktails, probably. And then how much money are you going to take home with you compared to how much you brought?
A lot less.
A lot less. And did you have a good time? No.
What if someone really does find pleasure in that, though? the whole chapter before says, chapter 5 says, whatever you do, make it fun. enjoy what you do.
He doesn't say right, wrong here. He says better. What's the house of mourning, and why is that better than the house of feasting?
Because it's just like, they see the vanity, pretty much.
Because?
They see the vanity.
Yeah. What does the house of mourning mean?
Like, the contrast I see is like, kind of the house of mourning is kind of really opening your eyes to kind of reality.
Yeah, living in reality.
And then the house of mirth is just kind of like seeking escapism.
That's exactly it. Yeah, that's exactly it. Living in the real world, which has suffering and sorrow and hurt, and you may be doing well, but maybe a friend has had a terrible accident or lost somebody in an accident or something, and can you comfort them? Can you, you lost your job. Well, that's not exactly fun. Can you see how do you suppose God sees the world every day? How does God look down at 6 million people every day? What do you think he feels? Do you think he feels great joy over the wonderful way that 6 billion people are treating each other in the world? But he surely weeps over the world every day. Now, the end of all men is going to be death and sadness and sorrow in comparison with joy. Jesus said, when you see me, your sorrow will turn into joy. Jesus will wipe away the tears from everyone's eyes. So that even when a Christian dies, there's sorrow as you let go of old things and see yourself more realistically and you leave old things behind and you go home to be with the Lord. There's sorrow in that, but there's immediate joy that follows. So that's there. Sorrow is better than laughter. That means stop and do a reality check on your life from time to time. Hey, what am I living for? Does my life have content and meaning? Am I really, is God using me? Can God use me? By a sad countenance, the heart is made better. When you repent, when you stop and look at yourself, and you make changes there, sometimes a little painful. Oh my gosh, I've really been kind of blowing it lately. I was really insensitive to my roommate, or I really hurt that other person, or I'm being awful flippant. When you do a reality check, sometimes you feel temporarily very sad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. That is, you're going to do reality checks. The heart of fools is in the house of mirth. So there's the comparison. The person whose whole lifestyle is bent on the pursuit of pleasure is a fool. The person who does reality checks is wise. So that's the contrast. And if you like to go to Las Vegas and you get great pleasure out of a weekend there in the slot machines, I don't think he's saying that's not, he isn't speaking against that.
Is that kind of what he was saying earlier when he said it's better to be wise than it is to be a fool?
Yeah. Can you have as much fun doing something else instead of blowing all your money in the slot machines in Las Vegas? Well, if you enjoy the slot machines in Las Vegas and you can afford to lose X dollars and you really get your kicks out of it and it's once in a while, then go, Brian, go.
Well, say you set aside a certain amount of money, so that you and a couple of your friends or whatever can just go and blow, you save up money so that you can go and blow it just to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
That's all right.
Yeah.
Right?
Would you make is that your lifestyle?
No.
No.
Just going once in a while.
Yeah, and it's pre-planned.
Yeah.
And it's to relax and unwind, then I'd say that, yes, that's good, isn't it? Does everybody see that?
Yeah. But you were talking about in the second chapter, you were saying how, you could have, some big party and really enjoy yourself, but at the end you kind of have to do the cleanup.
Yes, and then what happens after this? What do you do? How do you feel on Monday when you're driving home? Do you feel happy about the weekend when you drive home on Monday, or does everybody have a hangover and nobody got enough sleep and you had a big fight with a couple of your friends on the way and the food wasn't that good and the weekend turned out disappointing? What's the net? Was it worth it in the end? Can you go back and say, gee, that was a great weekend. We had a great time. We've got to do that again next year. That would be the thing that... there are people that go across the border to the houses of prostitution on the weekend to have a wonderful time. Would you say that God would tell those people that that's fine and allow them to have pleasure and fulfillment in that even if it was only once a year? No. No, that would never... You'd never get in the position where God could say, go for it. So this presupposes that you're doing things that are legal and legitimate and moral. Verse 5, it is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. This is funny. For like the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. Now, if you have a pot in the fireplace and you want to boil a stew, and you don't have any wood, but you have a bunch of thorns that you got in the backyard to heat the pot. Well, what about thorns, a big bunch of thorns under the pot to heat the pot? How do thorns burn?
I'm guessing they crackle.
They crackle a lot. How much heat do you get out of them? They burn right up.
Yeah,
They burn right up and there's no heat, then there's a lot of noise. So you're not going to get the kettle cooked. So that's what he says here. He says, you'd be better off to hear a correction, a word of correction from somebody who's wise than to listen to the song of fools. And the thing about the fool, when the fool's talking to you, it's crackling. It makes a crackling like a fire. It's attractive and maybe charismatic. What would be the song of fools today? And what would be the word, the opposite of that? Anything that makes you buy into the popular culture.
Going to Vegas and blowing all your money. Handing over the deed to your house.
Taking the trip to Las Vegas but not planning ahead and quitting after you've decided to spend the amount of money you put in your budget. But you sign over the deed to your house. Yeah, that would be it sure looks good for a little while, but it's got a very bad end. Surely oppression destroys a wise man's reason, and a bribe debases the heart. The end of a thing is better than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Do not hasten in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. Now, he's saying that it's easy to get ripped off. It's easy to get taken advantage of. It's easy to be wronged in the world. And what's your tendency? How do you tend to react when things have gone wrong? How do we all tend to react? Things are not gone the way you planned them.
Get frustrated?
You get frustrated and then you get angry. Mm-hmm. And then what?
Take it out on someone?
Yeah, then that's exactly what that's about. Be patient in spirit. To be patient in spirit and wait for God to fix it is better. Don't hasten in your spite to be angry. Angry rests in the bosom of fools. If you try to correct it, you'll overcorrect. You won't be fair about it. So, life is not always going to be fair, and you're going to get some curveballs thrown at you, and how are you going to handle those things? And can you handle them in stride? Can you be a little patient with defeat and setback? Can you be willing to be wronged a little while, knowing that in the long run God will fix it? We all know people that are very touchy, very quick to set you straight, and that's foolish. Verse 10 is neat. Do not say, why were the former days better than these? If you do this, you're not inquiring wisely. What's that? Well, that's the longing for the good old days.
Yeah.
I'll tell you kids, back in the good old days, when we didn't do things like this, I'll tell you, you'd never stay out late. When I was a boy, your parents were strict, but we had a much better life then, and I'll tell you, my gosh, the hard work on the farm. Kids today are lazy and they're sleazy. And I'll tell you, I long for those good old days. Mm-hmm. And what Solomon say here?
It's just not wise to.
Just the good old days weren't good old days.
Yeah.
They were just as bad as now. That's a wonderful little proverb. So he says, don't say the good old days were all that good. And if you do that, dwelling in the past.
Yeah.
Isn't that what we like to do? Oh, gosh, I'd like to go back to my first wife. My first wife was a lot better than my third. And I had it really good in my previous job. Man, if I could get that first job back.
Yeah.
The moment you start dwelling on the good old days, then you're not living in the present anymore. That's the see all the wisdom that comes out of Solomon here. That's just practical, like Proverbs. See,
mm-hmm.
A lot of the Proverbs are written by Solomon.
Yeah. This reminds me kind of the end of chapter 5, where it says, He will not much remember the days of his life, but God keeps him occupied with gladness of heart.
And yes.
Hopefully, like,
that's exactly right.
If you dwell on the past, will be enjoying the present.
If you have a very full life now, then you're not going to be daydreaming about either the future or the past. And just as much, in addition to people that are locked in the past, there are the people that are having a miserable life today because it's going to get good tomorrow. And that's the same. Verse 11, wisdom is good with an inheritance and profitable to those who see the sun. Wisdom is a defense as money is a defense. But the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it. Which means... You've got your wise man, and you have a good inheritance. You've got resources. Is that a good thing? Yep. Is money a good thing? Yep. Nice to have some of that money in the bank. Is there an advantage to being well informed? Yes. So once again, he's saying here that it's better to be reasonably well informed and make good choices than it is to be reckless with your life. Consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, and in the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find nothing that will happen after him. Why does God do that? God makes things, some things in your life that you can't fix. Some things that are wrong in the world that you can't change. He gives you some days of joy and prosperity, and he sends you some days of trouble and adversity, and there's not a lot you can do about that. And God has done that deliberately in order that, why? This is true for all men and women. Why does God do that? Who's in charge? Hello. Hello, hello. Hello.
Yeah, they're ready.
These guys didn't go skiing. They were up praying all night. Why does God do this?
I'm thinking like two things.
I'm thinking
one is like it's for us to kind of learn kind of the wisdom that we talked about earlier, but I think it's also like to trust Him. I don't know.
If life is frustrating a little bit, would you be more likely to trust God? Yeah. God, I don't understand what's going on. Man, I don't think you're being fair, Lord. Is it okay to tell God that? That you don't think he's being fair? That you'd like to have him run things differently than he already is? And you're mad at him? Is that alright? Sure it is. He's your father and he loves you and he would like you to come near to him. That's what he would like. And he would like you to stop and think, man, I had a great day. Thank you, Lord, for that. Thanks for my new friend. Thanks for this and that. Or today was really hard, Lord, and I don't see what you have in it for me now, but will you help me? See all that? About whether you like it or not, God's running the universe according to his own plan. And you can't persuade him. He's not going to change the whole direction of history just to suit you. I remember when I was a new Christian and I got scared one day that the Lord was going to come right away. And I remember going out and telling God that he couldn't dare do that. That I wasn't ready and I was not going to allow him to have Jesus come back that day. And I thought, that's interesting to hear me blackmailing God like that and telling him what he could do and not do and ignore the timing of his program for 6 billion people and that I could hold God hostage like that. And get him to change. Or you know, people who fall in love and insist that they've got to get married, then they really ought not to get married. And so they tell God, God, you have to change your mind, and you have to put a blessing on this relationship because we have decided that this is the one relationship that we want. So, God, we're going to just go ahead and assume that we're going to get you to change your opinion on this, when you already said no. So, that's ridiculous when you think about it. And it would be terrible if it wasn't that we're dealing with a very good God who enjoys blessing us. Verse 15, I have seen all things in my days of vanity. There is a just man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. It is a very unfair world. Here is a really neat, wonderful, marvelous young man, young woman who dies young, right in the prime of life. And they're so gifted, and they have so much to contribute, and they had an accident where they got cancer and died at 20 years old, and what a sad thing. And then right around the corner there is this monstrously evil man like Pol Pot in Cambodia who slaughtered 20% of the population, a couple million people, and he lived to a ripe old age. All kinds of evil men live to a ripe old age. And a lot of really good people die young. Now that isn't fair at all.
A lot of people in the world say like, or like, blame God, like, if somebody dies young, say, oh, why, like, no, why? Otherwise, why God takes good people away?
Yeah. People always want to know that. Yeah.
Yeah, but the old people aren't necessarily enjoying their life. What if they're hating their life?
And where are they going when they die?
Increased torture.
Yeah, so they live longer and it tortures them more.
Maybe, that's right. It's going to be fantastic. Yeah.
And the people who die young, maybe they've enjoyed life that much more.
That's right. And where are they going?
So it depends if they're a saint or not.
Yeah. Something better, yeah. If they're Christians, they're going to a better place. Do not be overly righteous, and don't be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Now that's okay. There's a lot of that. This is heavy. Don't be overly righteous, and don't be overly wise. Overly righteous would be self-righteous. Don't be self-righteous, and don't be overly wise. There's like the two extremes in life. One extreme is the kind of legalism of being self-righteous and prudish and
by the book.
And the other extreme in life, the opposite extreme, is this: the person that here is called overly wise. The opposite extreme is, oh, it doesn't really matter. I say live life up to the full, and God will always forgive you if you mess up. The opposite extreme is being loose and unrestrained and misusing your liberty, being presuming on God's grace, presumptuousness, which is two extremes. Somewhere we ought to be somewhere in the middle, right? Because the person on either of these extremes is destroying himself. Do not be overly wicked, nor be foolish. Why should you die before your time? You could shorten your life if you decided to get on to cocaine right now, or heroin. Get on to heroin because it's fun, and you might very well die of a stroke in a very short time.
Or suicide.
Or?
Suicide.
Yeah, suicide, yeah.
Or you could want to crash and fly into a building.
Well, I think if he crashes, if Dave crashes into a building, he'll be having fun at but he's flying. He won't do it deliberately. He'll just be stunt flying. It is good that you grasp this. It's good that you understand this. That you remove your hand from the other. He who fears God will escape them all. In other words, don't be stupid about life. Look at the extremes in life and don't get caught up in those extremes. And the person who fears God will escape these pitfalls in life. The pitfalls on the extremes of overindulgence, of being too permissive, being too loose is one extreme. The other extreme is being rigid, uptight, by the book. That's just as bad. The prudish self-righteous person. So, put your life in the middle of the stream with God and enjoy a balanced life. That's the whole thing. Solomon is a man who went to both extremes to see what was there. And he comes back and he says, no, I'd rather be more or less in the middle here.
So basically he was curious and did the overstream of curiosity and then lobbed up instead of that.
Yeah, he wrote
like a warning to people, I guess.
Yeah. Wisdom strengthens the wise more than 10 rulers in the city. Imagine that. That if you are tuned into God by wisdom, you're better off than the city council. When the city council sits down to deal with the management of the entire city, they're not going to do nearly as well as one man that's talking to God. And, verse 20, there is no just man on earth who does good and does not sin all the time. There's no man that doesn't stumble and fall and screw up. No man. And there's no one of us that does good all the time. Right? Sober view of your life? Not perfect? Well, that's the cure for self-righteousness. This would give you humility and respect for God. You're doing really well, but you could stumble and fall. You might.
It doesn't say you will.
There's nobody on earth who's good all the time, only Jesus. And there's nobody on earth who never sins.
Yeah.
No such thing. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. The Greek word there means to shoot an arrow and miss the target. To miss the point of life. Well, sin is falling short of what you ought to be. Do you all fall short of what you ought to be? Yeah. Do you all fail to do something that you should have done? Yeah. Do you all blow out once in a while? Yeah. So that's the compassion and mercy of God is what we need. Verse 21, do not take to heart everything people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. For many times also your own heart has known that even you have cursed others. That's funny, really, if you think about it. How many times do you sort of get mad at somebody and say something bad about them behind their back and it gets back to them? And in the heat of the moment you said, that guy is a stupid, idiot, jerk. And you didn't mean it. Or maybe you did mean it, but that's not the...
I wanted to find out.
And so don't take everybody too seriously. Don't take anybody too seriously, even your own servants. Or your best friends or your parents. Your parents have a bad day and they yell at you. Or your roommate is grouchy and gives you a really hard time. Well, you don't weigh everything by that momentary experience. So don't take seriously everything, every criticism. You know how people can get super touchy.
Oh, yeah.
And have you ever been guilty of saying anything bad about anybody? No. Never. So there's real humor in it. We're all sinners, and we have all been sinned against. We have all been victims of sin, and we all have hurt others. And so that's the universal condition. All this I have proved by wisdom. In other words, I found this out by my research. And I also said, I will be wise, but it was very far from me. Or, it was harder to find than I thought. I've got a very deceitful heart. I'm quite capable of deceiving myself, and Solomon says here. I think I'm wise, but I'm not always as wise as I think. As for that which is far off and exceedingly deep, who can find it out? Wisdom is sometimes far off and it's exceedingly deep and it's hard to find. I applied my heart to know and to search and to seek out wisdom and the reason of things, to know the wickedness and the folly and foolishness and madness. I looked hard for wisdom. Real wisdom is rare in human experience. I find it more bitter than death. The woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are fetters, He who pleases God will escape from her, but the sinner will be taken by her. So here he's had he's seen in some of his 700 wives, he's seen that some of them are manipulative, ripping him off and not being very faithful, and he's very frustrated that bitter than death, that some of the love affairs he's gotten into have caused him great pain and heartache.
He is alone. Hardly trapped all the wives.
Yeah. So he knows that one.
Oh, that's the only other one.
So we don't know ourselves very well, so we're very easily taken in. All of us are very easily caught. But you like somebody, and that person that you like is out to take something or get something or need something, and they're manipulating, and we're easily deceived. That happens in love affairs a lot. You know, you think you're getting the most wonderful lover in the world. And here's what I found, says the searcher, adding one thing to the other to find out the reason, which my soul still seeks, but I cannot find. One man among a thousand I have found, but a woman among all those I have not found. Truly, only this I have found, that God made man upright, but man has sought out many schemes. This is supposed to be a little humorous. He's saying, I've looked all over Jerusalem and all over the world, among all the men that I know, and only one in a thousand is worth really trusting. And I've looked over all my wives and all the women I've known, and I can't even find one in a thousand. Now that's not a put down on women, especially in view of the way he set himself up for disaster. But what's the whole point? What's this chapter saying in its conclusion here? The lie. It sums it all up.
Let me see if I can. I think this is the first thing. Let me see if I got like God. God made like man like if I read this right, but we tend to search for other things than God.
Yeah.
Search for things that replace God.
God made you upright. He made you upright, and what do we do? What is this? Seeking out many devices, scheming, manipulative. The heart of man is deceitful above all things. Desperately corrupt, who can understand it? Do you know your own heart? No. Are you capable of being deceiving yourself? Yeah. Can you rationalize things in your life and convince yourself you should do them when they're wrong? Yeah. Do you find that other people can deceive you? Yeah. And betray you? Yeah. Screwed up world, eh? Among all the many friends that you have and the many friends that you love, how many are really, really people that you can totally trust? That's pretty rare, isn't it? It's sort of sad, but that's kind of a summary. So what about today? What about this?
I think that there's a lot of aspect of what life, life and wisdom in life, and like how you, I guess how you should approach it.
Yes, life, there's a lot of mystery in life. I think that's in here too. There's a lot that we don't understand about ourselves and about the world, and we can't go by things that are on the surface. And it's a fallen world, and there's evil in the world, and there's not many people that really are choosing to fear God and walk with God. That makes it even worse. So what should this do? What is this? We shouldn't be presumptuous. We shouldn't be quick to judge. We don't want to become self-righteous. We don't want to throw all caution to the winds. We don't want to be uptight. We still come back to the middle ground of God would like us to enjoy life and have a great time and have a wonderful, fulfilled life. But
maybe like this, I guess, end-wise, what do we do? Why do it? That's good or bad.
And so in the end,
see God,
in the end you go to the Lord about many things. Talk to God about everything. and draw near to God about everything and bring Him into your, all of your plans and hopes and dreams. And God is not just for Sunday morning. He's for 24/7, 365.25. And if you do that, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly at heart, and you will find rest for your souls. My yoke is easy and my burden is light, said the senior ox to the junior ox. Yoke up with me and I will help you plow the field, and we will go and I will do all the work, but we're going to plow the field together. So, and if you yoke up with me, I'm a senior ox and I know how to plow straight furrows, and it's work, but you'll be fine, and it'll be restful and enjoyable. Will you yoke up with me? That's the, and if you do, then you rest, Sabbath rest. Whoever has entered God's rest has ceased from his own efforts, as God did from his. So that the Christian life is resting in the strength of Jesus who dwells in you. And if you rest in him and call on him, he is there. Jesus, in the New Testament, is the wisdom of God. He himself is called the wisdom of God. In Ecclesiastes and in Proverbs, wisdom is personified as a woman. The woman that you should get to know because she's like a good wife or a good mother or a good sister. But in the New Testament, Christ is the wisdom of God. So this, the wisdom that is elusive to Solomon here, we now know is in Jesus.
I like how... like in the Gospels, like the Pharisees were like putting down Jesus kind of because of their self-righteousness.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you're hanging out with drunkards. And,
yeah.
You know. It's just, oh.
That's right. The criticism of the Pharisees is
I could just, yeah, you see this.
Because they're falling more than the law.
Yeah. How about you praying for us?
Okay.
Not that we need it.
Oh, God, I just... Just thank you so much just for meeting us here today, Lord, and just speaking your truth to us, Lord. And I just pray that we would really just take these words to heart, Lord, that we would really seek to be just genuine people, Lord, that have true righteousness, Lord, not self-righteousness or following just the wickedness of this world, Lord. But that we would just hold close to you, Lord, as you... would teach us how to be just whole people, Lord. Amen.
Okay. This is all iPodded here. 1 hour and 2 minutes, and it all goes on my website if anybody wants extra credit.